"You found arsenic?" said Vimes.
"Yes, sir, lots. The sample's full of it, but..."
"Well?" Cheery looked at her feet.
"I tried my process again with a test sample, sir, and I'm sure I'm doing it right."
"Good. What was it in?"
"That's just it, sir. It wasn't in anything from the palace, because I'd got a bit confused and tested the stuff I found under Father Tubalcheck's fingernails, sir."
"What?"
"There was grease under his nails, sir, and I thought maybe it could have come from whoever attacked him. Off an apron or something. I've still got some left, if you want a second opinion, sir. I wouldn't blame you."
"Why would the old man be handling poison?" said Carrot.
"I thought he might have scratched the murderer," said Cheery. "You know, put up a fight."
"With the arsenic monster?" said Angua.
"Oh, gods," said Vimes. "What time is it?"
"Bingly, bingly, beep, bong. Oh, damn." "It's 9 o'clock, said the organiser, poking its head out of Vimes's pocket. "I was unhappy because I had no shoes until I met a man with no feet."
The watchmen exchanged glances.
"What?" said Vimes, very carefully.
"People like it if I occasionally come up with a little aphorism or inspiring thought for the day," said the imp.
"So, how did you meet this man with no feet?" said Vimes.
"I didn't actually meet him," said the imp. "It was a general metaphorical statement."
"Well, that's it then," said Vimes. "If you'd met him, you could have asked him if he had any boots he didn't have any use for."
There was a squeak as he pushed the imp back into its box.
"There's more, sir," said Cheery.
"Go on," said Vimes, wearily.
"And I had a careful look at the clay we found at the murder scene," said Cheery. "Igneous said it had a lot of grog in it. Old powdered pottery. Well, I chipped a bit off Dorful to compare, and I can't be sure, but I got the iconograph demon to paint really small details, and I think there's some clay just like his in there. He's got a lot of iron oxide in his clay."
Vimes sighed. All around them people were drinking alcohol. One drink would make it all so clear.
"Any of you know what any of this means?" he said.
Carrot and Angua shook their heads.
"Is it supposed to make sense if we know how all the pieces fit together?" Vimes demanded, raising his voice.
"Like pieces of a jigsaw, sir?"
Cheery ventured.
"Yes," said Vimes, so loudly that the room went quiet. "Now all we need is the corner bit, with the piece of sky and the leaves, and it'll all be one big picture."
"It's been a long day for all of us, sir," said Carrot.
Vimes sagged.
"Okay," he said. "Tomorrow, I want you, Carrot, to check on the golems in the city. If they're up to something, I want to know what it is. And you, Little Bottom, you look everywhere in the old man's house for more arsenic. I wish I could believe that you'll find any."
Angua had volunteered to walk Little Bottom back to her lodgings. The dwarf was surprised that the men let her do this. After all, it would mean that Angua would then have to walk on home by herself.
"Aren't you afraid?" Cheery said as they ambled through the damp clouds of fog.
"Nope.
But I imagine muggers and cutthroats would be out in a fog like this, and you said you lived in the shades."
"Oh, yes, but I haven't been bothered lately."
"Ah, perhaps they're frightened of the uniform."
"Possibly," said Angua.
"Probably they've learned respect."
"You may be right."
"Excuse me, but are you and Captain Carrot?"
Angua waited politely.
"Oh, yes," said Angua, taking pity. "We're... But I stay at Mrs. Cake's boarding house because you need your own space in a city like this."
"And an understanding landlady sympathetic to those with special needs," she added to herself, "like door handles that a paw could operate, and a window left open on moonlit nights.
You've got to have somewhere where you can be yourself. Anyway, the watch house smells of socks."
"I'm staying with my Uncle Armstrangler," said Cheery. "It's not very nice there. People talk about mining most of the time."
"Don't you?"
"There's not a lot you can say about mining. I mine in my mine, and what's mine is mine," said Cheery in a sing-song voice. "And then they go on about gold, which, frankly, is a lot duller than people think."
"I thought dwarfs loved gold," said Angua.
"They just say that to get it into bed."
"Are you sure you're a dwarf? Sorry, that was a joke."
"There must be more interesting things. Hair, clothes, people."
"Good grief, you mean girl talk?"
"I don't know. I've never talked girl talk before," said Cheery. "Dwarfs just talk."
It's like that in the watch, too," said Angua. "You can be any sex you like, provided you act male. There's no men and women in the watch, just a bunch of lads. You'll soon learn the language. Basically, it's how much beer you supped last night, how strong the curry was you had afterwards, and where you were sick. Just think egotistical. You'll soon get the hang of it, and you'll have to be prepared for sexually explicit jokes in the watch house. Cheery blushed. Mind you, that seems to have ended now, said Angua.
Why? Did you complain?
No. After I joined in, it all seemed to stop, said Angua. And you know they didn't laugh. Not even when I did the hand gestures, too. I thought that was unfair. Mind you, some of them were quite small gestures.
There's no help for it. I'll have to move out, sighed Cheery. I feel all wrong.
Angua looked down at the little figure trudging along beside her. She recognised the symptoms. Everyone needed their own space, just like Angua did, and sometimes that space was inside their heads. And she liked Cheery, oddly enough. Possibly it was because of her earnestness, or the fact that she was the only person apart from Carrot who didn't look slightly frightened when they talked to her. And that was because she didn't know. Angua wanted to preserve that ignorance as a small precious thing, but she could tell when someone needed a little change in their lives. "We're going quite close to Elm Street," she said carefully. "Just drop in for a while. I've got some stuff you could borrow." "I won't be needing it," she told herself. "When I go, I won't be able to carry much." Constable Downspout watched the fog. Watching was, after staying in one place, the thing he did best. But he was also good at keeping quite still. Not making any noise whatsoever was another of his best features. When it came to doing absolutely nothing at all, he was among the finest. But it was keeping completely motionless in one place that was his forte. If there was a roll call for the world champion non-movers, he wouldn't even turn up. Now, chin on his hands, he watched the fog. The clouds had settled somewhat, so that up here, 6 stories above the streets, it was possible to believe you were on a beach at the edge of a cold, moonlit sea. The occasional tall tower or steeple rose out of the clouds, but all sounds were muffled and pulled in on themselves. Midnight came and went. Constable Downspout watched and thought about pigeons. Constable Downspout had very few desires in life, and almost all of them involved pigeons. A group of figures lurched, staggered, or in one case rolled through the fog, like the 4 horsemen of a small apocalypse. One had a duck on his head, and because he was almost entirely sane except for this one strange particular, he was known as the Duck Man. One coughed and expectorated repeatedly, and hence was called Coffin Henry. One, a legless man on a small wheeled trolley, was for no apparent reason called Arnold Sideways, and the fourth, for some very good reasons indeed, was called Foul Old Ron. Ron had a small greyish-brown, torn-eared terrier on the end of a string, although in truth it would be hard for an observer to know exactly who was leading whom, and who, when push came to shove, would be the one to fold at the knees if the other one shouted, "Sit!" Because although trained canines as aids for those bereft of sight, and even of hearing, have frequently been used throughout the universe, Foul Old Ron was the first person ever to own a thinking brain dog. The beggars, led by the dog, were heading for the dark arch of Misbegot Bridge, which they called Home. At least one of them called it Home. The others respectively called it Hawk, 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 Hee, Whoops, and Bugger It, Millennium, Hand and Shrimp. As they stumbled along the riverside, they passed a can from hand to hand, drinking appreciatively and occasionally belching. The dog stopped. The beggars shunted to a halt behind it. A figure came towards them along the riverside.
"He goes, Ptee! Bugger it!"
The beggars flung themselves against a wall as the pale figure lurched past. It was clutching at its head, as if trying to lift itself off the ground by its ears, and then occasionally banging its head against nearby buildings. While they watched, it pulled a metal mooring post out of the cobbles and started to hit itself over the head. Eventually the cast iron shattered. The figure dropped the stub, flung back its head, opened a mouth from which red light spilled, and roared like a bull in distress. Then it staggered on into the darkness.
"Eh, that's a golem again," said the duck man. "The white one. I gets heads like that myself some mornings," said Arnold Sideways.
"I knows about golems," said Coffin Henry, spitting expertly and hitting a beetle climbing the wall 20 feet away. "They ain't supposed to have a voice."
"Buggery," said foul old Ron. "Dang the twigger for a bang in the fussel on shrimp. Cause the worm's on the other boot. See if he don't."
"He meant it's the same one we saw the other day," said the dog, "after that old priest got topped." "Do you think we should tell someone?" said the duck man.
The dog shook its head. "Nah," it said. "We've got a cushy number down here. No sense in spoiling it." The five of them staggered on into the damp shadows.
"I hate bloody golems taking our jobs."
"We ain't got jobs."
"See what I mean? What's for supper?"
"Mud and old boots."
"Millennium hen and shrimp," I says.
"Glad I got a voice. I can speak up for myself."
"It's time you fed your duck."
"What duck?"
The fog glowed and sizzled around 5 and 7 yard. Flames roared up and all but set the thick clouds alight. Spitting liquid iron cooled in its moulds. Hammers rang out around the workshops. The ironmasters didn't work by the clock, but by the more demanding physics of molten metal. Even though it was nearly midnight, strong-in-the-arms iron founders, beaters and general forging were still bustling. There were many strong-in-the-arms in Ankh-Morpork. It was a very common dwarf name. That had been a major consideration for Thomas Smith when he'd adopted it by official deed poll. The scowling dwarf holding a hammer which adorned his sign was a mere figment of the sign-painter's imagination. People thought dwarf-made was better, and Thomas Smith had decided not to argue. The Committee for Equal Heights had objected, but things had mired somewhat because, firstly, most of the actual committee was human, since dwarfs were generally too busy to worry about that sort of thing, and for the most part were unconcerned about matters of height. There's a dwarfish saying, "All trees are felled at ground level," although this is said to be an excessively bowdlerized translation for a saw which more literally means, "When his hands are higher than your head, his groin is level with your teeth." And in any case, their position hinged on pointing out that Mr. Strong-in-the-Arm, nay, Smith, was too tall, which was clearly a sizes discrimination and technically illegal under the committee's own rules. In the meantime, Thomas had let his beard grow, wore an iron helmet if he thought anyone official was around, and put up his prices by 20 pence on the dollar. The drop hammers thumped, all in a row, powered by the big ox treadmill. There were swords to beat out and panels to be shaped. Sparks erupted. Strong in the arm took off his helmet, the committee had been around again, and wiped the inside.
"Dibbock, where the hell are you?"
A sensation of filled space made him turn. The foundry's golem was standing a few inches behind him, the forge light glowing on his dark red clay.
"I told you not to do that, didn't I?"
Strong in the arm shouted above the din. The golem held up its slate.
"Yes. You've gone and done all your holy day stuff. You were away too long."
"Sorrow.
Well, now you're back with us. Go and take over on number 3 hammer and send Mr. Vincent up to my office, right?"
"Yes."
Strong in the arm climbed the stairs to his office. He turned at the top to look back across the red-lit foundry floor. He saw Dibbock walk over to the hammer and hold up a slate for the foreman. He saw Vincent, the foreman, walk away. He saw Dibbock take the sword blank that was being shaped and hold it in place for a few blows, then hurl it aside. Strong in the arm hurried back down the steps. When he was halfway down, Dibbock had laid his head on the anvil. When Strong in the arm reached the bottom, the hammer struck for the first time. When he was halfway across the ash-crusted floor, other workers scurrying after him, the hammer struck for the second time. As he reached Dibbock, the hammer struck for the third time. The glow faded in the golem's eyes. A crack appeared across the impassive face. The hammer went back up for the fourth time.
"Duck!"
screamed Strong in the arm, and then there was nothing but pottery. When the thunder had died away, the foundry master got to his feet and brushed himself off. Dust and wreckage were strewn across the floor. The hammer had jumped its bearings and was lying by the anvil in a heap of golem shards. Strong in the arm gingerly picked up a piece of a foot, tossed it aside, and then reached down again and pulled a slate out of the wreckage. He read,
"The old men helped us. Thou shalt not kill, clay of my clay. Shame. Sorrow."
His foreman looked over Strong in the arm's shoulder.
"What did he go and do that for?"
"'How should I know?' snapped Strong in the arm. "'I mean, it brought the tea round this afternoon as normal as anything. "'Then it went off for a couple of hours, and now this!'
Strong in the arm shrugged. A golem was a golem, and that was all there was to it. But the recollection of that bland face positioning itself under the giant hammer had shaken him.
"'I heard the other day the sawmill in Dimwell Street wouldn't mind selling the one it's got,' said the foreman. "'It's sawed up a mahogany trunk into matchsticks or something. "'You want I should go and have a word?'
Strong in the arm looked at the slate again. Dibbuk had never been very wordy. He'd carry red-hot iron, hammer-sword blanks with his fists, clean out clinkers from a smelter still too hot for a man to touch, and never say a word. Of course, he couldn't say any words, but Dibbuk had always given the impression that there were none he'd particularly wanted to say in any case. He just worked. These were the most words he'd ever written at any one time. They spoke to Strong in the arm of black distress, and a mind that would have been screaming if it could only have uttered a sound, which was daft. The things couldn't commit suicide.
"'Boss,' said the foreman, "'I said you want me to get another one?'
Strong in the arm skimmed the slate away, and with a feeling of relief watched it shatter against the wall.
"'No,' he said, "'just clear things up and get the bloody hammer fixed.'
Sergeant Colon, after some considerable effort, managed to get his head higher than the gutter.
"'Yeah, you're right, Corporal Lord Denobbs,' he mumbled. "'Dunno, Fred. Whose face is this?'
"'It's my Nobby.
Thank God for that. I thought it was me.'
Colon fell back.
"'We're lying in the gutter, Nobby,' he moaned. "'Oh, we're all lying in the gutter, Fred, but some of us are looking at the stars.' "'Well, I'm looking at your face, Nobby. Stars would be a lot better, believe you me. Come on.'
With several false starts, they both managed to get upright, mainly by pulling themselves up one another.
Where are we, Nobby?
I'm sure we left the drum. I've got a sheet over my head.
It's the fog, Nobby.
What about these legs down here?
I reckon them's your legs, Nobby. I've got mine.
I reckon I drunk a lot, Sarge. Drunk as a lord, eh?
Nobby reached gingerly up to his helmet. Someone had put a paper coronet around it. His questing hand found a dog-end behind his ear. It was the unpleasant hour of the drinking day when, after a few hours' quality gutter time, you're beginning to feel the retribution of sobriety while still being drunk enough to make it worse.
How'd we get here, Sarge?
Colon started to scratch his head and stopped because of the noise.
"'I reckon,' he said, winnowing the frazzled shreds of his short-term memory, "'I reckon seems to me there was something about storming the palace and demanding your birthright.'
Nobby choked and spat out the cigarette.
"'We didn't do that, did we? You were shouting we ought to do it. Oh, gods,' moaned Nobby. "'But I reckon you threw up around that time. That's a relief, anyway.' "'Well, it was all over Grabber Hoskins, but he tripped over someone before he could get us.'
Colon suddenly patted his pockets.
"'And I've still got the tea money,' he said.
Another cloud of memory scudded across the sunshine of oblivion. "'Well, 3 pennies of it.' The urgency of this got through to Nobby.
"'Thruppence?' "'Yeah, well, after you'd started ordering all them expensive drinks for the old bar, well, you didn't have no money, and it was either me paying for 'em or—'
Colon moved his finger across his throat and went,
"'You telling me we paid for happy hour in the drum?' "'Not so much happy hour,' said Colon, miserably. "'More sort of ecstatic 150 minutes. I didn't even know you could buy gin in pints.'
Nobby tried to focus on the fog.
"'No one can drink gin by the pint, Sarge. That's what I kept saying. And would you listen?'
Nobby sniffed. "'We're close to the river,' he said. "'Let's try to get—'
Something roared very close by. It was long and low, like a foghorn in serious distress. It was the sound you might hear from a cattle yard on a nervous night, and it went on, and then stopped so abruptly it caught the silence unawares.
"'Far away from that as we can,' said Nobby.
The sound had done the work of an ice-cold shower and about 2 pints of black coffee. Colon spun round. He desperately needed something that would do the work of a laundry.
"'Where did it come from?' he said. "'It was over there, wasn't it? I thought it was that way.'
In the fog, all directions were the same.
"'I think,' said Colin slowly, "'that we ought to go and make a report about this as soon as possible.'
"'Right,' said Nobby. "'Which way?'
"'Let's just run, eh?'
Constable Downspout's huge pointy ears quivered as the noise boomed over the city. He turned his head carefully, triangulating for height, direction, and distance. And then he remembered it. The cry was heard in the watch-house, but muffled by the fog. It entered the open head of the golem Dorful and bounced around inside, echoing down, down among the small cracks in the clay, until, at the very edge of perception, little grains danced together. The sightless sockets stared at the wall. No one heard the cry that came back from the dead skull, because there was no mouth to utter it, and not even a mind to guide it, but it screamed out into the night.
"'Clay of my clay, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not die!'
Samuel Vimes dreamed about clues. He had a jaundiced view of clues. He instinctively distrusted them. They got in the way. And he distrusted the kind of person who'd take one look at another man and say in a lordly voice to his companion, "'Ah, my dear sir, I can tell you nothing except that he is a left-handed stonemason who has spent some years in the merchant navy and has recently fallen on hard times.' And then unroll a lot of supercilious commentary about calluses and stance and the state of a man's boots, when exactly the same comments could apply to a man who was wearing his old clothes because he'd been doing a spot of home bricklaying for a new barbecue pit, and had been tattooed once when he was drunk and 17, these terms are often synonymous, and in fact got seasick on a wet pavement. What arrogance, what an insult to the rich and chaotic variety of the human experience. It was the same with more static evidence. The footprints in the flowerbed were probably, in the real world, left by the window cleaner. The scream in the night was quite likely a man getting out of bed and stepping sharply on an upturned hairbrush. The real world was far too real to leave neat little hints. It was full of too many things. It wasn't by eliminating the impossible that you got at the truth, however improbable. It was by the much harder process of eliminating the possibilities. You worked away, patiently asking questions and looking hard at things. You walked and talked, and in your heart you just hoped like hell that some bugger's nerve would crack and he'd give himself up. The events of the day clanged together in Vimes's head. Golems tramped like sad shadows. Father Tubalcheck waved at him, and then his head exploded, showering Vimes in words. Mr. Hopkinson lay dead in his own oven, a slice of dwarf bread in his mouth. And the golems marched on silently. There was Dorful, dragging its foot, its head open for the words to fly in and out of, like a swarm of bees. And in the middle of it all, Arsenic danced, a spiky little green man, crackling and gibbering. At one point he thought one of the golems screamed. After that, the dream faded a bit at a time. Golems, oven, words, priest, Dorful, golems marching, the thudding of their feet making the whole dream pulsate. Vimes opened his eyes. Beside him, Lady Sybil said, and turned over. Someone was hammering at the front door. Still muzzy, head swimming, Vimes pulled himself up on his elbows and said to the nighttime world in general, "What sort of a time do you call this?"
"Bingley, bingley, beep,"
said a cheerful voice from the direction of Vimes's dressing table.
"Oh, please.
5:29 a.m. A penny saved is a penny earned. Would you like me to present your schedule for today? While I am doing this, why not take some time to fill out your registration card?"
"What? What?
What are you talking about?"
The knocking continued. Vimes fell out of bed and groped in the dark for the matches. He finally got a candle alight and half ran, half staggered down the long stairs and into the hall. The knocker turned out to be Constable Visit.
"It's Lord Vetinari, sir. It's worse this time."
"Has anyone sent for Donut Jimmy?"
"Yes, sir."
At this time of day, the fog was fighting a rearguard action against the dawn and made the whole world look as though it were inside a ping-pong ball.
"I poked my head in as soon as I came on shift, and he was out like a light, sir."
"How did you know he wasn't asleep?"
"On the floor, sir, with all his clothes on."
A couple of watchmen had put the patrician on his bed by the time Vimes arrived, slightly out of breath and with his knees aching.
"Gods," he thought, as he struggled up the stairs, "it's not like the old truncheon and bell days. You wouldn't think twice about running halfway across the city, coppers and criminals locked in hot pursuit."
With a mixture of pride and shame, he added, "and none of the buggers ever caught me either." The patrician was still breathing, but his face was waxy, and he looked as though death might be an improvement. Vimes's gaze roamed the room. There was a familiar haze in the air. "Who opened the window?" he demanded.
"I did, sir," said Visit, "just before I went to get you. He looked as though he needed some fresh air."
"It'd be fresher if you left the window shut," said Vimes. "Okay, I want everyone, I mean everyone, who was in this place overnight, rounded up and down in the hall in 2 minutes, and someone fetch Corporal Littlebottom, and tell Captain Carrot."
"I'm worried and confused," he thought, "so the first rule in the book is to spread it around."
He prowled around the room. It didn't take much intelligence to see that Vetinari had got up and moved over to his writing desk, where, by the look of it, he had worked for some time. The candle had burned right down. An inkwell had been overturned, presumably when he'd slipped off the chair. Vimes dipped a finger in the ink and sniffed it. Then he reached for the quill pen beside it, hesitated, took out his dagger and lifted the long feather gingerly. There seemed to be no cunning little barbs on it, but he put it carefully on one side for Littlebottom to examine later. He glanced down at the paper Vetinari had been working on. To his surprise, it wasn't writing at all, but a careful drawing. It showed a striding figure, except that the figure was not one person at all, but made up of thousands of smaller figures. The effect was like one of the wicker men built by some of the more outlandish tribes near the hub, when they annually celebrated the great cycle of nature and their reverence for life by piling as much of it as possible in a great heap and setting fire to it. The composite man was wearing a crown. Vimes pushed the sheet of paper aside and returned his attention to the desk. He brushed the surface carefully for any suspicious splinters. He crouched down and examined the underside. The light was growing outside. Vimes went into both the rooms alongside and made sure their drapes were open, and then went back into Vetinari's room, closed the curtains and the doors, and sidled along the walls looking for any telltale speck of light that might indicate a small hole. Where could you stop? Splinters in the floor? Blowpipes through the keyhole? He opened the curtains again. Vetinari had been on the mend yesterday, and now he looked worse. Someone had got to him in the night. How? Slow poison was the devil of a thing. You had to find a way of giving it to the victim every day. No, you didn't. What was elegant was finding a way of getting him to administer it to himself every day. Vimes rummaged through the paperwork. Vetinari had obviously felt well enough to get up and walk over here, but here was where he had collapsed. You couldn't poison a splinter or a nail because he wouldn't keep on nicking himself. There was a book half buried in the papers, but it had a lot of bookmarks in it, mostly torn bits of old letters. What did he do every day? Vimes opened the book. Every page was covered with handwritten symbols. You have to get a poison like arsenic into the body. It isn't enough to touch it. Or is it? Is there a kind of arsenic you can pick up through the skin? No one was getting in. Vimes was almost certain of that. The food and drink were probably all right, but he'd get detritus to go and have another one of his little talks with the cooks in any case. Something he breathed? How could you keep that up day after day without arousing suspicion somewhere? Anyway, you'd have to get your poison into the room. Something already in the room. Cheery had a different carpet put down and replaced the bed. What else could you do? Strip the paint from the ceiling? What had Vetinari told Cheery about poisoning? You put it where no one will look at all. Vimes realized he was still staring at the book. There wasn't anything there that he could recognize. It must be a code of some sort. Knowing Vetinari, it wouldn't be crackable by anyone in a normal frame of mind. Could you poison a book? But so what? There were other books. You'd have to know he'd look at this one continuously. And even then, you'd have to get the poison into him. A man might prick his finger once, and after that he'd take care. It sometimes worried Vimes the way he suspected everything. If you started wondering whether a man could be poisoned by words, you might as well accuse the wallpaper of driving him mad. Mind you, that horrible green colour could drive anyone insane.
Bingley beep beep bleep.
Oh, no.
This is your 6 a.m. wake-up call. Good morning. Here are your appointments for today. Insert name here. 10 a.m.
Shut up. Listen, whatever's in my diary for today is definitely not...
Vimes stopped. He lowered the box. He went back to the desk. If you assumed one page per day... Lord Vetinari had a very good memory. But everyone wrote things down, didn't they? You couldn't remember every little thing. Wednesday, 3 p.m, Reign of Terror, 3:15 p.m, Clean Out Scorpion Pit. He held the organizer up to his lips. "Take a memo," he said.
"Hooray! Go right ahead. Don't forget to say memo first."
"Speak to a blast. Memo. What about Veterinary's Journal?"
"Is that it?"
"Yes." Someone knocked politely at the door. Vimes opened it carefully. "Oh, it's you, Little Bottom." Vimes blinked. Something wasn't right about the dwarf.
"I'll mix up some of Mr. Donut's jollop right away, sir."
The dwarf looked past Vimes to the bed.
"Ooh, he doesn't look good, does he?"
"Get someone to move him into a different bedroom," said Vimes. "Get the servants to prepare a new room, right?"
"Yes, sir."
"And after they've done it, pick a different room at random and move him into it, and change everything, understand? Every stick of furniture, every vase, every rug."
"Yes, sir."
Vimes hesitated. Now he could put his finger on what had been bothering him for the last 20 seconds. "Little Bottom."
"Sir?"
You on your ears?"
"Earrings, sir," said Cheery nervously. "Constable Angua gave them to me."
"Really? Right. I didn't think dwarfs wore jewellery, that's all."
"We're known for rings, sir."
"Yes, of course. Rings, yes. No one quite like a dwarf for forging a magical ring. But magical earrings? Oh, well. It was some waters too deep to wade."